Resonance Rewind with Robin Pierce, Jessica Burtis, Jenny Bill, Poppy Booth, Eloise Sheehan and Alex Levchuk, travelling across the decades to consider the impact of popular cult TV and film on the universe.
Adam Svensson, spare part surgery, the impact of the teleprinter, and a future mother of Doctor Strange and Sherlock Holmes. All this and more in the latest edition of Resonance Rewind. It's UFO, not an offensive term for anybody who's actually out there in terms of a variety of other bits and pieces, but unidentified flying object. Gerry Anderson's UFO, in many ways, the lighter version of the Invaders. Or is it? I don't know. We'll find out in this edition of Resonance Rewind, where we actually welcome from Lincoln, England, Eloise Sheehan. How are you, Eloise?
I'm good. Thank you, Alex.
Splendid. From North Carolina, in North Carolina. Clearly. USA, it's Jessica Burtis. How are you, Jessica?
I'm great, thank you.
Brilliant. From somewhere in Norway, where as Slarty Bartfast said, the crinkly bits made him so much better, it's our new Norwegian correspondent, Jenny Bill. How are you, Jenny?
I'm fine, thank you very much. I'm in Moss.
Moss.
The town. Not the green stuff, but I'm in the town of Moss.
I'm sure they have Moss in Moss. And it could be a whole new wonderful world of that. And of course, safe in Wales, and no matter whether you're socially distanced or not, we have Robin Pearson. Of course, he is socially distanced because rather like the Welsh government, he will be all set for the second wave, which is apparently on its way or has arrived, Robin.
Reclusive by choice, I'm here.
And just in case people were wondering, as far as the team is concerned, this is not actually a bib. It is indeed SHADO, Supreme Headquarters Alien Defence Organisation.
For the benefit of our listeners, Alex is wearing a shirt. Now, it's black, and it has like a white front. And when I saw him on Zoom, the first thing I thought was, is he wearing a bib? I couldn't see the Shadow logo, which I would have recognised. I was just thinking, you know, we're both in our 60s. These things
happen.
No,
actually, sorry, Robert. I am not. I have not arrived at that 7th decade as yet. You may well be, but don't try to actually put me into that chronologically gifted area. Sorry, but there we are. I have my birth certificates to hand as well. Good grief. Sixth decade, not seventh.
In that case, it's Mr. Pierce to you, Sonny.
Anyway, let's move on. Would you like to do the usual precy in terms of UFO and that opening series episode, of course, Identified?
Indeed. UFO, Unidentified Flying Object, was a 1969 series produced by Gerry and Sylvia Anderson. It was a dramatic breakaway from their usual format of having marionettes, as they pioneered with Supercar, Thunderbird, Stingray, Captain Scarlet, and so on. And it took a far more serious topic as well, of Earth in 1980 being visited by extraterrestrials with hostile intent. Now, their hostile intent, we're not too sure of until the end of this episode, but we know that they're not here for any beneficial means. Now, the episode starts with a UFO attack, As I said, we don't know why they're here. The governments of the world and the military are certainly aware that they're here and have set up a task force to defend the Earth from these aliens, called the Supreme Headquarters Alien Defense Organization. Now, they are secretly hidden under a film studio, Elstree, and the commander of the task force is Ed Straker, ably played by Ed Bishop. He has his subordinates. The pilot episode really just introduces the show, the characters, the scenarios. They have a base on the moon from which they can launch three interceptors. They have a submarine, not sure if it's a fleet or just the one, where the bow detaches and becomes a fighter plane as the second means of defense. They have a ground force of shadow mobiles, which are like tanks. Basically,
and let's hold it there, Robin. Let's hold it there, because I think we've covered a whole range of aspects of that, including, in fact, historically, our first ever midweek drivette, although in those days it was actually called Media Matters. Ed Bishop, of course, who started off his term on the programme back in 1982, obviously 2 years after the fictional series UFO was actually established, and became a semi-regular up until his sad demise in 2005. He kind of paved the way, obviously, a duo with the late, great Shane Rimmer, who also appears in this episode as the pilot. Okay, I've got a number of issues with this particular episode, to the extent of there are moments where I'll say, Gerry Anderson, as a director, what were you thinking? Were you trying to get a quickie divorce from Sylvia Anderson in terms of blatant casual sexism, or what? But anyway, let's move on to Jessica. Have you managed to have a look at UFO in terms of, obviously, the counterpart, the British equivalent, although, you know, with the classic line, the clincher is at the back, delivered from General Henderson, before, of course, that heavily escorted police vehicle is attacked by UFO. And, of course, tough for Peter Carlin's sister, who doesn't even get to actually chance to get to stand up before she's actually shot and executed by a machine gun carrying alien. It's so much easier in the world of Bud's Diner, I can tell you. Anyway, Jessica.
I actually enjoyed it. I thought it was very different from the last Alien show that we watched. This one did not terrify me, thankfully. It kind of reminded me of Race to Witch Mountain in a way, with how the aliens were trying to, you know, save themselves from a dying planet by coming to Earth and using it instead.
Race to Witch Mountain. Interesting, a line from that. Of course, Project Blue Book was in vogue. The whole notion of flying saucers had been around for the last 20 or so years. I talked about the impact of the teleprinter, because what high-energy, high-octane sports show, or indeed science fiction series, was replete back in the closing decades of the 20th century without a teleprinter, which actually churns out and lets you know exactly what you're seeing, together with the subliminally splashed 1980 coming on board. Plus, of course, the fact that Aisha Bruff, also actually an erstwhile midweek drivette, although mostly via the Stone tapes, because she's a great friend of David and Sam Stone, of course, is the first backside that the camera hones in on, as under the line identified, we see a furry bedecked Aisha Bruff's character wandering in to obviously have lots of casual sexism hurled at her by Alec Freeman. But that's another line entirely. Let's move on to Eloise. Obviously, I'm getting out my woke credentials early for this one, Eloise.
Yes, you are. To be honest, I was a bit confused by it. I constantly felt like I was missing some part of the narrative, but obviously that's their idea of how it was scripted. But other than the confusing narrative, who on earth let the costume designer loose? That costume designer should be locked up, and that's all I have to say about that, really.
No, you mean you're not a fan of Nehru suits? I mean, surely the Nehru suit was something which was critical to time in the 1980s, and in fact, you know, without those sort of Nehru suits, we just would not actually have had the sort of joys of Alec Freeman and indeed Ed Straker, obviously running through that. Also, what's not to love about Ed Bishop's wig in his role as Commander Ed Straker? genius. You know, it just sort of shows the whole sort of philosophy of what a military person would actually use 10 years after he'd supervised the creation of an underground supreme headquarters alien defense organization, whilst at the same time effectively ruining his marriage at the same time. Spoiler alert, that comes up later in the series. Jenny, I know you're a big fan of this particular series, and so am I, actually, but somehow rewatching it again, I don't know. I think this is not the best episode on which to judge it by. However, over to you, Jenny.
Well, let me just say that that's not a wig that he's wearing initially. He dyed his hair, but he went on to wear a wig later on because he got fed up with dyeing his hair. But yes, I've been waiting months for today because I absolutely love this programme, and I'm sorry, but I absolutely adore the outfits. I would wear them all, and I would wear them today. I think the costumes are fantastic. The music's fantastic. I love the programme, the sets. I think it's great that actually in this particular episode, they really put together the premise for the series in the dialogue so that you actually know kind of what it's all about and a little bit about the backgrounds of the people. And it was obviously made for an more adult audience, and I mean, I know a lot about the series because I've watched it time and again. It deals with a lot of kind of more deeper, darker issues with a lot of the characters. I love it.
Okay, well, you just don't sit on the fence, Jenny, as we like to appreciate. Now you've moved to Norway, say what you really mean. You know, the world needs it. I mean, those Norwegians, as I say, the fjords alone, we consider Hitchhiker's Guide at a later date.
I was going to say, it was my childhood dream to be a moon girl when I grew up.
And indeed, you almost wear the hairstyle which kind of echoes that particular thing today with respect to those purple wigs, which many fashionistas have actually said, why the purple wigs? Some Anderson fans have actually said, well, it was an attempt to actually shield them from radiation waves, etc. A weak excuse, it has to be said. But then when the character portrayed by Gabrielle Drake of Gay Ellis can actually say, well, I guess we could all do with a bit of action, is the line. And then she says, well, I could do with a cup of coffee. And clearly, you know, the notion of off-duty, on-duty. I mean, I think there were a lot of brave attempts that were actually there. But, and I'll come back to Robin in a second, one of the lines which critics at the time said, and I think it's echoed down the ages about this, in comparison to series like Thunderbirds, which we'll consider in a few weeks' time, like Captain Scarlet and so on, is Gerry and Sylvia Anderson used to make series peopled with puppets. He now seems to have actually done the same with respect to people, but the puppets were more expressive and you cared about them more.
Thank you.
Robin, over to you.
Well, first of all, I don't really agree with what you said about this not being the best episode to introduce or to judge the series on, because
it didn't have Michael Billington in. It didn't have Paul Foster, probably the best character. He wasn't in there.
Because
or Maddox Shable's Dr. Jackson.
Because the series evolved really well as it went on. I mean, they dedicated a whole episode to the breakup before the pilot episode of Straker's marriage in Confetti Check, A-OK. And I think that this series holds up spectacularly well for a 1969 episode. Now, okay, there are going to be inevitably comparisons with, say, Star Trek, and there is wild and rampant sexism here. George Sewell's character of Alec Freeman is a wretched specimen, is he not?
If you were to go into a film studio and actually put your hand on the hand of a female administrator,
well it's obvious that Shadow have no HR department.
you are talking. I mean, there are and also a line that his character, and I'm divorcing obviously George Sewell the actor, sadly no longer with us, probably because the amount of cigarettes that people smoked. If you actually look at the number of cars that have actually gone down of cancer, it's
the rampant alcoholism, because he always went into Ed Straker's office for a drink. You know, I'm just going to go to the boss's office and help myself to whiskey. Hang on a second, Alec. You've got to go chasing UFOs. You need to be sober, man.
I quote from a wonderful little excerpt in this particular episode. Alec Freeman, you never touch it, do you? Self-control. Maybe drinking means more self-control. No, yeah, Colonel Freeman, it doesn't mean more self-control.
What does that even mean?
Exactly.
You know, the one thing I kind of take issue with, and you brought up the whole woke thing, is this was made in 1969, and I don't think it's really fair to judge a 1969 series by 2020 standards, because...
Robin, I will qualify that, right. Because actually, if you look at all of the other series, including Stingray, I don't think you have that amount of blatant sexism actually on display. When I was watching this as a child, I felt a little bit uncomfortable.
They were aimed at children, though. UFO really wasn't. You don't put, you know, 10-year-old...
But Space 1999 was a much more mature... And actually, again, avoided that particular trap.
Well, maybe it's because Barbara Bain and Martin Landau were married in real life. But, I mean, we see George Sewell these days playing Alec Freeman and basically flirting with anybody who is wearing a skirt or a purple wig.
Robin, not just and that. I'm sorry, I'm on a roll here, but when he's actually piloting the plane, his line is, "These clouds give us about as much cover as a G-string on a belly dancer."
Exactly.
The show is actually worse than the 1930s comments you get in the old musicals, and that's saying something considering the standards back then. I was quite shocked. So.
Yeah, thank you, Eloise. I mean, I know they're going for an adult audience, but that doesn't mean adult as in R-rated, as in XXX movie, etc. You know, it's different lines here. Jerry, what were you thinking?
I took it as being kind of like Carry-On type humour, because I mean, we'd be mortified if they made Carry-On films these days, but you're watching a slice of history from 1969 today, and I don't think that the same standards can apply. It is a historical document of how, you know, leading men were portrayed at the time. I mean, last night I was watching an old black and white episode of The Saint, and I was frankly appalled by how much Roger Moore smokes in any single episode, and the fact that he took his leading lady and put her over a knee and spanked her on primetime TV. I mean, you know, you can't do that these days, but they could do it back then. You know, part of me was thinking when Sewell was issuing these lines and flirting outrageously with Wanda Ventum, it's like, dude, you have such a lived-in face. You're not going to get away with this. You know, I mean, you're two notches away from being but ugly. I'm sorry.
Well, Virginia Westlake, of course, the character portrayed by Vonda Wendham, who actually had the ultimate routine because she replaced, obviously, the character of Alec Freeman in the second part of the series because the American distributors said he has to go. So I think even on that basis, you look at shows such as Star Trek, such as Land of the Giants, such as The Invaders, and even on that basis, when you're looking at a future situation, and remember The Saint was not set of the future, we're not talking about that in this particular case, but I think you have got issues in terms of, whoa. This is, however, as a white male, I'm not really qualified to actually talk about this particular aspect because, you know, let's step away from this. Jessica, let's bring on board your own self. Were you as shocked as Eloise saying, even in the 30s, pre-Hays Code, this was quite shocking?
I think so. I was like laughing to my roommate when she watched it with me, and I was like, it's only the intro and we already have like two gratuitous shots of women's bodies that like weren't needed at all. And I was kind of, yeah, the whole show was a little shady with some of those things.
And the line with a Freeman and the character of the blonde technician who has passed all the tests, to which he replies, you know, sotto voce, I bet you have. I mean, even carry on with my difficulty
James,
with
isn't it?
That.
A partner actually came in and asked if I'd accidentally clicked on the wrong type of website when I was watching this. So,
but were those costumes actually, I mean, the ones that the women were, which were incredibly, I mean, they were skin tight for no reason. They weren't functional at all, were they? But were they really worse than those ridiculous micro mini dresses in Star Trek?
Yes.
I think the entire fishnet bodysuits were a bit too much as well. What were they about?
Females. At least for the women, there were the men wearing string vests on Skydiver for no reason that I can think of.
It is worth noting that clearly if you're working in a nuclear-powered submarine, then obviously a string vest is the best way to obviously keep maximum efficiency to the fore. But there we are. Jenny, you were a fan of the costumes and so on. Would you like to offer some kind of defence and say, actually, I thought Sylvia outdid herself with these costumes?
I thought Sylvia outdid herself with the costumes. And and I'm sure many famous designers would be very jealous. I thought, as I said before, obviously I'm a bit of a punk rocker, and the fishnet and the silver and the glittery is right up my street. I think also the fact that it was made in the late 60s, and if you look back to the late 60s at programmes that were made then and the way women were treated in society, I think the programme, they decided they wanted to make a more mature programme, and they tried to make it very, very sexy. And I think making it very sexist was just part of their way in those times of making it sexy. Although, of course, you know, many years later, we're looking at it. And I mean, I was actually appalled. I thought, goodness me, I never realised there was so much sexism in it and all the smoking and drinking. But, you know, it's part and parcel of that decade.
Commander Straker blowing smoke rings in Central Control. It's not big. It's not clever. However,
and again, within the 60s, I mean, being in inverted commas sexy usually meant back then making it more appealing to men. They never thought about what would be appealing to the women, did they? Because the women would just sort of like, you know, pandering, because it's a part of that society that I mean, yes, I was alive in 1969, but I've seen great change over the years, and I'm glad to have seen it, to be honest with you. Because in many ways, women were treated more or less like pets, weren't they?
Yeah. Don't get started. Before long, we'll have Tessa Snart talking about her latest doggy that's come on board, effectively.
Isn't it cute, though?
Yeah. He's just a German Shepherd puppy, that's all. He will grow
up. Oh, my heart's melting.
Beautiful.
You started this.
The first UK transmission, of course, was on Wednesday, September the 16th, 1970. It didn't actually receive a network premiere until BBC Two picked up the show and actually screened it in 1996. It's interesting that after sort of being screened through the States in 1972, originally, the official line as far as transmission in Britain was concerned is, I think after the first 10 or so episodes, it was switched to late night, Sunday evenings, 11 p.m. and so on and so forth. And again, we probably will return and consider various other aspects as well. I talked about Adam Svensson, of course. Adam Svensson, the alter ego of Captain Blue in the series Captain Scarlet, and where Ed Bishop came to the fore as far as things were concerned for that. Another little question I just have to throw out here. It's been discussed and debated by fans across the years, so maybe Jenny can actually appreciate this. Three interceptors. Why have they only got one missile each? So if they actually miss the UFO, or if there are, shall we say, four UFOs as opposed to three UFOs coming in, then automatically one will get down. The best response I've actually heard so far is, well, it's to ensure Skydiver or the mobiles have something else to actually blow up.
Exactly. I've no idea why the aliens just didn't bring in a whole fleet. They kind of sort of did in Reflections in the Water, but, you know, If one gets past the three interceptors and they are not known for their aim, even though one of them became a Bond villain, one of them was the Milk Tray Man, you know, they're not known for their aim. They should have been Imperial Stormtroopers. The UFO gets past them. Usually Skydiver will miss it because, you know, Skydiver somehow for a submarine manages to be exactly where the UFO seems to be. I don't know how fast that thing can go, unless it's...
But on the plus factor, it's always nice to have the received pronunciation tones of the space intruder detector effectively announcing that the end of the world with coronavirus is nigh. Anyway, Jenny, any thoughts? Red alert. Red alert.
They only have one thing on each ship is because the alien ships only come one at a time as well. So that's the reason.
I have a question. Does anybody feel as crushingly sorry for poor old Ford as I do? Because throughout the series, he's sitting there at his little monitor, and whenever Commander Straker goes near him, he looks like he wants to burst out crying because Ed Bishop always snaps at him. It's always, you know, something's gone wrong. Ford, don't just sit there. Do something.
To use contemporary vernacular, Robin, he tears him a second one. End off.
Yes, exactly.
And a third and a fourth.
Jessica, let's talk about characters. Which characters really resonated with yourself? Was it Gay Ellis in the Moonmace Commander? Was it Commander Straker? Was it Alec Freeman? Was it as we just heard, the operator portrayed by Keith Alexander? Who actually sort of, you thought, actually, I'd like to find out more about them?
Gonna be honest, with a lot of the characters, I didn't know their names. I was kind of like, oh, it's like the blonde guy. These are like the purple-headed girls. I don't exactly know their names. I'd say like the blonde woman. I wanted to know more about her. I thought she was very funny. I thought she, I don't know, there's something to her. I was like, she has something to say. There's something here. I want to know.
Portrayed, of course, by the future mother of Benedict Cumberbatch, Vonda Ventum, of course. And she was indeed Colonel Virginia Lake. So, yes, and I think she did actually sort of have our way through that. And even actually got Alec Freeman to turn around and say, gentlemen and ladies, we're likely to come under fire, and so on and so forth. Eloise, what about characters for yourself? Who floated your boat, if any?
Probably the alien. I hope he comes back and harvests all the main characters. That'd be quite entertaining. Yeah.
He's not, because he suffered from accelerated decrepitude, and the obvious clincher was he, through a mystery of coincidence and the universality, actually had the heart of the commander of Skydiver's sister.
Which I meant the aliens in general, but... So I'm assuming Eloise, there's more.
Eloise obviously going big on the aliens in general. Well, you know, interesting. What about yourself, Jenny? I mean, are you going to actually fulfill the usual cliche saying fundamentally nobody can beat Ed Straker?
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to say nobody else could be Ed Straker. I thought Ed Bishop, I mean, I really like Ed Bishop. I loved him when he was Captain Blue. I think he plays the role really well. I think he's he's very kind of serious. It's almost a little OTT, but he makes it believable. And I think he makes his character believable, certainly later on in the series. I think his acting, I think, holds it together quite well.
Okay, Robin.
Definitely Commander Straker, because in the 60s, Captain Kirk would always beam down. He would always be the first to run into action. But, of course, we know in real life that the general leads from the back. And this is something that they did later on in Star Trek Next Generation with Picard. And it's something they ably demonstrated with Ed Straker, who knew and carried the weight that he would possibly be sending people to their deaths. And I always got the impression that he was short and snappy because of the weight of responsibility. And his character was fully fleshed out in the episode I mentioned earlier called Confetti Check USA. A-OK, I'm sorry. And he suffered when they did a second block of filming towards the end of the series where they actually made him a man of action. And I thought, no. His place is back in the office directing his troops. Let people like Alec Freeman and later on Paul Foster, who was the sort of young buck of the team, take the action. And, you know, he was more of a strategist, only going into action when he had to, or in the case of a duty tour of Skydiver, you know, it sank.
Let's not get started on Sub Smash, because that's a whole other episode entirely. As is the want, of course, the notion of science fiction considering philosophy and so on, the concluding lines, is this the end of the beginning? Where does the universe end? Where does it begin? The closing words of Ed Straker in terms of that. It's a little bit like Resonance Rewind. Where does it end? Where does it begin? You can watch all, you can go through all sorts of other aspects. But we have reached the time where we need to start beginning to quantify the qualitative experience that is UFO. And let's start again with Jessica. Jessica, was there any of the costumes? I mean, I think you could probably actually carry off, if you try in North Carolina, if they ever take away lockdown restrictions, you could probably try one of those moon women outfits, possibly.
Yeah, I guess that's a new Halloween idea. I would love to have the colorful hair. yes.
So marks out of 10 for this particular episode?
I think I'm going to have to give it a 7.5. I have to give it the little half for the kooky music. It was something like Scooby-Doo to me. I liked the green paint on the alien as his skin color. That was pretty good. The costumes, I did actually like the silver skirts. I thought that was pretty cool. So.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, in terms of the design, of course, you mentioned the music. Let's not forget Barry Gray. We almost did, but you brought our attention to it. I think Barry wrote some outstanding material for UFO, and indeed all the Gerry Anderson series, and we've been listening to some of that during the course of this Resonance Rewind. I did feel that his opening very jazzed-up session as the alien takes the machine gun to the Carlin family was perhaps a little OTT, but nevertheless, and equally, there was a tendency with respect to his shadow theme for it to be a little bit borderline sleazy, perhaps, but you know, again, bearing in mind at that stage of Elm Street, of course, it moved later. Let's say, in purposes of the fictional world and the universe that Shadow exists, it's the Harlington Straker Film Studios, because clearly that's the essential line of the whole system.
Thank you.
And what about the cars? I mean, what's not to love about those automobile cars, those wonderful cars, including a cameo that Aisha Bruff's character walks past of the wonderful Model T, the yellow Model T Ford from Secret Service, the series before this, and it goes those gullwing cars, which were superb. Eloise, has that managed to sort of, because I'm getting a sense that 7.5 could be a high point at this particular stage, but what about yourself?
I didn't hate it. There's problems with it, obviously, but there is just no things. It wasn't what I expected, but I did really appreciate the set. So I liked the bright orange colours, and that is a lot different to the normal greys and greens you keep getting. And along with Jessica, I really like the music. And the idea at the end when they said that this could easily be us in a few years, like the aliens. So I'll probably give it a 6 out of 10.
Yeah, and of course Eloise did actually speed watch this, so maybe if she has time sometime at another time to actually watch it as a slightly more refined routine and actually give it time to actually go over, then it might be better. I'm going to actually, and this could actually ignite some controversy, so I admit that. Great fan of Gerry Anderson, worked with Gerry Anderson and so on. I think this is a very strong series in parts, but it's also very weak in parts. It's almost the best of times, the worst of times. I actually think the characterization across the series, and I'll disagree with Robin here, was better in The Invaders. But of course, we're not considering series here. We're looking at individual episodes and so on. And I still felt that David Vincent, even at the time, actually coped better. And it would be nice to see an alternate universe where Vincent actually meets Ed Straker and maybe they work together. It would mean that David Vincent had friends. And as an architect, he might have one or two things to add to the Harlington Straker film studio. Who knows? Maybe he did, because it was 1980. And of course, Invaders was of its time in 1967-68. As a result of that, I'm going 8.5, the same score as I gave The Invaders. So 8.5 for The Invaders and 8.5 this week for Identified, the episode of Gerry Anderson's UFO. The reason it lost that 1.5 points was, as I've mentioned, some of the characteristics were a little bit OTT. Jenny, are you going a straight 10 for this?
No, I'm not. I'm going to give it 11. I think, I really think that it's, you know, I just love everything about it. I think the only weak points in that were the little bits where they had the surgery and they just sort of saunter in when he's having surgery, which is not very...
Where's his masks? Where are his face masks? Where are his details? Is it any of this? It's a disaster.
And then when the nurse says, oh, he's dead, and there's no sort of frantic efforts to resuscitate him or anything, and they all just go, oh, okay, he's dead. But, I mean, to me, that was two sort of flaws. But other than that, I just think it's perfect. So I'm sorry, I have to give it 11, because I've already given a 10 one other week, and I want to go higher.
There you go. Twilight Zone matching your system there. So even moving over to Norway hasn't quite sort of dented the approach in terms of Jenny's views. Robin.
Yes, sir. Well, in contrast to you, I thought broadly similar concept to Invaders, but everything the Invaders got so lamentably wrong, repeatedly so, I thought UFO got absolutely dead on right. It's brash, it's colourful, it's fast moving, has one of the best theme music I can ever remember seeing, and the best title sequence. I mean, it all just pulls together so well. I'm giving it an unapologetic 9.
Mm. The Earth is faced with a power threat from an extraterrestrial source. We've moved into an age where science fiction has become fact. We need to defend ourselves. Some of the research for this particular piece has come from Chris Bentley's The Complete Book of Gerry Anderson's UFO. And if you notice, actually, on the cover, no sign of Alec Freeman whatsoever. We've got Michael Billington, obviously the late, great Michael Billington, as Paul Foster, Ed Bishop as Ed Straker, and Gabrielle Drake as Lieutenant Gay Ellis. We may well consider the episode that actually dealt very strongly with racism in the not-too-distant future, but... next week, we move into The Good Place. Some people might say we've already arrived on that particular aspect. The first episode of The Good Place, a four-season show, which launched a whole new world. That's pretty much it. So I think we keep resonating, people. Do we not?
We do indeed.